The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Law with June Grosso from Bloomberg Radio.
Obamacare is safe from a legal challenge at the Supreme Court once again. By a vote of 7-2, the justices rejected the third Republican attack on the landmark law that provides health insurance to 20 million people. The opinion did not deal with the merits of the case, but rather ruled the challengers didn't have the right to sue because they weren't injured by the now toothless individual mandate. This lack of standing was an issue Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Clarence Thomas brought up in the oral arguments by posing several hypotheticals.
Let's say Congress passes a law saying everybody has to mow their lawn once a week. And they even make a lot of findings about why that's a good thing. You know, it makes the country look neater. You get fresh air if you have to do that. Supports the lawnmower business. But the fine for violating it is $0. Do they have standing?
I assume that in most places there is no penalty for wearing a face mask or a mask during COVID. But there is some degree of opprobrium if one does not wear it in certain settings.
Joining me is Neil Kinkoff, a professor of constitutional law at the Georgia State University College of Law. Why a 7-month wait to hand down this decision, which is 7-2 and just 16 pages long?
That's a great question. I wish I knew the answer. Maybe someday the conference notes will tell us what was really going on. Because you're right, it's a 7-2 decision, and it's on a technicality, really, on standing. And so why did it take so long? And you can only imagine the justices were actually going back and forth about the merits and then decided to instead resolve it on this jurisdictional ground.
Yeah, so tell us why the court decided as it did.
So it ruled that the parties who brought the case didn't have the authority, the jurisdiction, to bring the case. So in order to bring a case, you have to be an actually injured party. So it can't be that you just think Obamacare is unconstitutional or you think the government is doing something that violates the law. That doesn't allow you to bring a lawsuit. You have to be actually personally harmed by the government's action. And then if you are, you can say, I'm harmed and the government is acting unconstitutionally. Court, please order a remedy. And so what the court said in this case is that the plaintiffs, there were two individuals and a set of 12 states. So the Supreme Court said, you haven't been directly harmed by anything the federal government has done. And if you pay attention to what the substance of the case was about, it's easy to see how that was the case. What they were complaining about is that Congress in 2017 amended Obamacare to remove the provision imposing a penalty on anyone who didn't buy the required insurance. And so what you had was this odd situation of two individuals who were complaining that there's a requirement that they buy insurance, but there's no actual penalty or anything that happens to them if they don't go ahead and do it. So the court said, you're not actually harmed. And then the states made an even odder argument, saying that their costs of running their state would go up because they have to run these insurance programs that cover people under Obamacare. The problem is, once you eliminate the penalty for not signing up for it, it's hard to see how the state is being harmed. In fact, if that's their concern, you would think removing the penalty helps them, because now people who don't want it aren't going to sign up for it to avoid a penalty. So if anything, it would reduce the state's costs. So the Supreme Court said, as to both of these parties, you're not personally injured. You're like anybody else who's just out there complaining that they don't like Obamacare. Because you don't have a direct personal stake in this, you are not allowed to bring this lawsuit.
The chief wrote the opinions of the court in the other Obamacare decisions and got a lot of criticism from conservatives. Is it surprising that he handed off this decision to Justice Breyer to write?
So it may be that the chief has decided that he's gotten enough blowback from Obamacare. That may have something to do with it. The chief, because he's in the majority, would be the one who assigned the writing of this opinion. I suspect that because the opinion has to do with standing and not with any of the merits, it's an issue that even among the justices is considered kind of a boring technicality. So I don't think anyone was really lobbying hard to get to write this opinion.
What did you think about Justice Alito's dissent? He called it the third installment in our epic Affordable Care Act trilogy.
So I just think it shows how contentious the issue is on the court. I mean, I think it also sort of betrays that Justice Alito isn't really viewing this as a law issue, that this is, for some of the justices, the kind of policy issue that you might hear debated and argued about on the cable news shows, and that it plays on that level with the justices. And I certainly think Justice Alito's dissenting opinion reads that way. It reads like it's written for that kind of an audience rather than your standard Supreme Court opinion audience.
Is the cloud over Obamacare gone now? Are the legal challenges behind us?
Well, it's hard for me to say they're entirely behind us just because there is so much interest in it, and therefore there is so much money available for lawyers and groups that want to challenge it. So it's possible we'll hear more of it. I would say that I think this is the Supreme Court telling people, we really don't want to hear about this anymore. Go away.
We'll see if they take that advice, Neil. That's Neil Kinkoff of the Georgia State University College of Law. Cases on abortion and gun rights are already on the Supreme Court's docket for next term. And now the justices are considering adding a third blockbuster case over whether to ban colleges from considering race in admissions. The case over whether Harvard College intentionally discriminated against Asian American applicants has been the most high-profile affirmative action case in years, drawing protests from both sides.
It's an important time to be critical of Harvard and to look at how affirmative action policies have impacted or discriminated against Asian American communities.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do.
those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Chinese Americans support affirmative action. We see how important it is to recognize diversity.
The justices are asking the Biden administration to weigh in on the Court of Appeals decision that upheld Harvard's policy of using race as a factor in admissions as a legitimate way to diversify its student body. Joining me is Susan Sturm, a professor at Columbia Law School. Let's start with the big question. What do you read into the Supreme Court asking for the Biden administration's view on the Harvard case?
You can't fully predict what the justices are about. My sense is that, number one, they're trying to really be thorough about the consideration. So this is a step of considering the perspectives of the United States when the administration has changed. They get the opportunity to have the administration weigh in. That has both the appearance of full consideration at every step, and also some justices may be really interested in learning something. This could be a formality. It could indicate more of a willingness to actually accept the case. It could be that there are some justices who feel they would get some information that would help in their informal deliberation.
So let's go back. Tell us about the First Circuit's decision.
First Circuit's decision upheld the Harvard admissions approach, which considers diversity as part of a compelling interest. And the First Circuit found that Harvard did not take race into account in a way that ran afoul of the Equal Protection Clause, and that considering race as part of holistic review is consistent with the Constitution. That was rejecting the arguments of Students for Fair Admission, suggesting that, as they are doing before the Supreme Court, number one, suggesting that any consideration of race would violate the Equal Protection Clause. And number two, that Harvard in this case considered the race of Asian American applicants in ways that demonstrated animus. The circuit rejected those arguments and really in a heavily factual analysis found that Harvard's admissions approach passed constitutional muster.
So the plaintiffs here, the Students for Fair Admissions, are outright asking the Supreme Court to overturn the landmark 2003 Grutter case.
Yes, they are. And part of the reason that there's serious concern about the decision to accept cert is that this is a case that relatively soon after that endorsement of Grutter. And the facts are fairly strong in this case in Harvard's behalf and have been so found both by the trial court and by the First Circuit. So there is a concern that with a change in the composition of the court, that if the court were to accept cert, that that might signal a willingness to either cut back dramatically the circumstances under which colleges and universities can explicitly consider race, or to eliminate that consideration completely. And this would be a deeply problematic decision on the part of the court.
Why I'm curious about the court asking the Biden administration for its input is that it seems pretty clear that the Biden administration is going to disagree with the position the Trump administration took supporting this lawsuit, because the Biden administration has already dropped the Yale lawsuit that the Trump administration brought.
It's a good question. And again, it's difficult to know whether the request is to really get updated views on the part of the government that will then inform a reconsideration internally to the court. That could be one signal. Another signal is just the interest of thoroughness. And I think Chief Justice Roberts is one who is interested in conveying an idea of legitimacy on the part of the court, even as it might be an activist court that's really cutting back on the court's role in affording racial justice. So this could be a process. You see, we've offered every opportunity at every step of the way, and this is a circumstance under which we still find it appropriate to change, to step back on what's called stare decisis, which is upholding settled precedent. Or it could be an effort to really seriously think about whether this is a time and a place to open up these questions about the propriety under the Constitution, as the court reads it, of taking race into account.
So it was just in 2016, I believe, that the court reaffirmed the consideration of race in college admissions, but that was by a 4-3 vote, and it's a really different court now. Tell us what the court decided in 2016 and how it's different now.
The court decided in 2016 that, first of all, reaffirmed that diversity is a compelling interest, which is what's required to take race into account under the Equal Protection Clause. That holistic review is warranted and permitted under the Equal Protection Clause, and that higher education institutions continue to be entitled to deference, given that they are the ones who are the best judges of the academic requirements, but that courts will give a searching review to how that judgment is exercised, and that there needs to be an evidence-based justification for taking race into account. So all of that was upheld and reaffirmed by the court in 2016, as you said, in this 4-3 decision.
So on that court, the three justices who were in dissent are still on the court. That's Chief Justice John Roberts and Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito. But two of the justices who were in the majority are no longer on the court. That's, of course, the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice Anthony Kennedy, who retired. So the court now is really different from what it was then. Do we know how the three new justices regard taking race into consideration in admissions?
There are some indications from their prior decisions that these new justices have embraced this kind of colorblindness approach, that looking at race as something that cannot be taken into account at all. Having said that, the configuration of the court is different, and I think there also is the possibility that what this means for the center of the court is that there may be a concern about thinking about stare decisis, namely the upholding of precedent, in a situation in which the world has not changed except for the composition of the court. So even though we have new justices, it's not a foregone conclusion that that will mean that the justices that were in the dissent in the 2016 opinion will then view this as a time to really cut back on or retract from a well-established precedent. And there are examples of the Chief Justice, for example, upholding a decision that he might personally disagree with, but that is clear precedent for which there is no established basis for cutting back. So we do have three new justices, at least two of whom might be very willing to take a radical approach to constitutional interpretation and to a more activist approach that reflects their own views of the Constitution. I don't think that tells us how the court would actually rule. I think there's some possibility that there would be cutting back, but not an overturning of precedent with this new majority.
I want to talk a little bit about Edward Blum, who leads the Students for Fair Admissions. He was also behind the lawsuit behind the Shelby County decision, which curtailed voting rights. Is he a one-man activist, or is this a vast organization?
We have to give him credit. He's been very effective as a small organization that has been able to, in part because of the change in the politics of the nation and the election of Donald Trump and the shift in the judiciary that has followed because of the judges that former President Trump appointed, that he's been able to really leverage a small amount of resources to have a big effect. And part of what he's done is really use the court system to compensate for the fact that he is a small organization, that there isn't a sense that this is a large, you know, populist movement. There have been very wealthy people who have financed his organization so that they can marshal legal resources to fight this battle. So he has been able to be quite effective marshaling the resources, legal resources, heavily financed by wealthy contributors, and then using the shift in the composition of the court to have really outsized impact.
So if you consider that there's no split in the circuits that the Supreme Court has to resolve, and the court is already going to be considering next term the controversial issues of abortion and gun rights, so what would be your guess as to whether or not the justices will take this case?
I think it's really anybody's guess as to whether the court will take this. I think that this depends in part on the appetite of the four justices to, as you've indicated, place the court smack in the middle of the most polarizing and controversial issues of our time, and to do that in a situation when there would be no question that were the court to dramatically cut back on or overturn the consideration of race in admissions, that the court would be taking a radical activist stance that is contrary to stare decisis. So the question is, does the court have an appetite for that with new justices on the bench and with these other issues that the court will also be facing? And it's hard to say because we have this new composition of the court, and that question about how the court is going to construct its role and its legitimacy with the populace is up for grabs. The law in this area is going to really get made on the ground. And the biggest concern that I have is that whatever the Supreme Court decides, that higher ed institutions and others will abdicate responsibility for dealing with issues of race in a way that outside of the judiciary have really engulfed the nation. There's a risk of the court system becoming even more out of touch with the realities of our time and the demands of the national racial reckoning that we're facing. And so I really hope the court does not take this case for all the reasons we discussed. And I really would urge higher education leaders and the lawyers counseling them to recognize that this is an area where law will be made in the day-to-day decisions of higher education institutions as much as by the Supreme Court.
Thanks for being on the show, Susan. That's Susan Sturm, a professor at Columbia Law School. And that's it for this edition of the Bloomberg Law Show. Remember, you can always get the latest legal news on our Bloomberg Law podcast. You can find them on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and at www.bloomberg.com/podcast/law. I'm June Grosso, and you're listening to Bloomberg.
Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.